tonight under the lights of this stadium. Even as we grieve, let's allow ourselves to dream of brighter days ahead. Because we won't be defined by this moment. We'll be defined by what we do because of it. After all, we are California. We don't wait for someone else to show us the way forward. We go first and we go boldly. We led in gay rights, gun rights, and criminal justice reform. And now we lead on combating COVID. You know, from the earliest days of this pandemic, California trusted in science and data, and we met the moment.
Governor Gavin Newsom delivering his annual State of the State address last night. The speech's setting, a nearly empty Dodger Stadium, symbolized how tumultuous the past year has been. Newsom called the home of last season's World Series champions the centerpiece of America's mass vaccination campaign. The pandemic dominated his half-hour address to the state the same way California's homelessness crisis did last year. He briefly touched on the recall effort against him in remarks that had, well, all the airs of a campaign kickoff.
And I just want you to know, we're not going to change course just because of a few naysayers and doomsdayers. So to the California critics out there who are promoting partisan political power grabs with outdated prejudices and rejecting everything that makes California truly great, we say this. We will not be distracted from getting shots in arms and our economy booming again. This is a fight for California's future.
All right, let's talk about Governor Newsom's speech last night and the prospect of his political future with Carla Marinucci. She covers California politics for Politico and writes their daily California Playbook newsletter. Hi, Carla.
Hey, Madeline. Good to be with you.
Good to have you. Well, first, let's talk about the location. Here he is in center field at Dodger Stadium with all these empty seats behind him. The first time really in decades this speech has been delivered outside Sacramento and in Southern California. So what does that symbolize?
Right.
What does that mean?
Yeah, I mean, in look and location, Gavin Newsom was going for a dramatic difference here. The audience was not legislators in Sacramento, in the Capitol, but voters out there. You mentioned, he said that this is a fight for California's future. It's also a fight for his political future. This was a pivotal moment for Gavin Newsom as he faces down what looks increasingly to be a recall election this year. He had to get that message out to them, and so did it at Dodger Stadium, one of the busiest mass vaccination sites in the nation, and those 55,000 empty seats behind him representing the California lives who've been lost to COVID-19. That was a sobering visual, a real departure, Madeline.
Yeah. And also a lot different than the very small and exclusive French Laundry restaurant in Napa Valley.
Absolutely right. And, yeah, as you noted, Newsom didn't actually mention the recall, but he mentioned those California critics. He also made a reference to that French Laundry dinner when he said, look, we have made mistakes. I have made mistakes, but we own them. And that dinner was the mistake that in part was the reason that he was there in Dodger Stadium last night in such a huge departure on this annual address.
Right. And so in the hours before he delivered the speech, former San Diego mayor Kevin Faulkner, who is dying to replace him in Sacramento, either as a result of a recall or later. He circulated a pre-buttal, and this is what he had to say.
For months, we gave him the benefit of the doubt. But time and time again, he has completely failed on delivering the basics. I believe there should be a high bar for a recall. Gavin Newsom has cleared it several times over.
What are the nature of the complaints on the part of the people mounting the recall?
Essentially, that Newsom has failed in the pandemic, failed to open businesses, failed to open schools, failed to deliver vaccines on time. That was the exact argument that Newsom went to last night in the State of the State, basically delivering sort of almost a silver lining playbook kind of approach, talking about all of the ways in which he has handled these very issues. Look, the Republicans know in California they cannot beat Newsom in a regular election. He is up for re-election in 2022. This is their shot at doing it. And it's going to be not just Kevin Faulkner, but maybe a number of Republicans that are up against him. And they are slamming him, particularly on the economic issues in California, how many businesses have closed and remain closed, how many schools still remain unopened. And that is, Madeline, Gavin Newsom's biggest challenge now as he faces down this recall, and mentioned it last night in the address, mentioned it this morning in another appearance in Los Angeles. The fact is, this is a campaign speech that he gave last night. He's now on a campaign. And as Kevin Faulkner is out there lambasting Newsom day after day, as is John Cox, the wealthy businessman who's also running, Democrats are now lining up to have his back. We saw Lieutenant Governor Eleni Koulounakis last night doing that, saying that Newsom has worked 24/7. A whole crowd of Democrats are out there today doing a rally and campaign event to stand by him, even those who have been critical of him, and even those on the far left, like Bernie Sanders, who's come forward this week and on a tweet, also criticizing this recall. This is where we're at right now. The state of the state last night was a campaign address to California voters, and Democrats now have the message to go forth and stand by Newsom as the critical dates come up this month.
Yeah, well, it's interesting how it's drawing national attention and national money, apparently, as well. Funds coming in to support the recall from outside the state. Apparently, they have the signatures. They say they have the signatures necessary to get it on the ballot, more 2 million or so. I think they only need 1.5 signatures. They need to be verified, of course. But after that, I mean, that might not happen till the fall, right? And by then, schools will likely be reopened, the economy in better shape. And
yes,
so
yeah,
it's an uphill battle, right, for the people who want to recall Newsom.
You're absolutely correct. I mean, this is all about timing and running out the clock. And look, you're right. The critical date comes up March 17th at 5 p.m. when those proponents have to churn in 1.5 million valid voter signatures. We'll see if they can do that. We should know by the end of April if there's going to be a recall. And many experts say if there is, considering the number of dates and hoops that have to be gone through, including looking at the cost of the recall and having the legislature approve it, et cetera, this election could not come before the voters maybe until October or November of this year. And a lot can change by then. We can have schools reopen. We can have businesses reopen. Yes. But then, as you know, Madeline, this is California, and stuff happens in California. That is a long time in a political year. We could have wildfires. We could have earthquakes, or who knows, right? So at this point, Newsom has to make his case in the strongest way possible. And he's doing things on the policy front that are backing him up. Talking about reopening schools this morning, talking about perhaps extending the school year into the summer. That'll go over very well with a lot of parents, and having national unions embracing that spirit, talking about how he's getting 2 million low-income vaccines into those low-income neighborhoods. That's going to go over well with Latino and Black communities here in California, those big voter issues in the Democratic Party. So right now, Newsom is laying the groundwork for what's ahead, and that's what we saw in his State of the State last night.
All right. Carla Marinucci from Politico. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, we are going to leave California. We're going to leave the United States. We're going to go to Italy and Israel to see how those countries are faring a year after COVID hit. That's next on Press Play.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. We're going to check in now with a couple of countries to see how they're handling COVID a year after the pandemic began in earnest. We'll go to Italy in a moment, the first Western nation to be hit hard. First, though, let's go to Israel, where life is returning to normal. Schools, bars, live sporting events, concert halls, they all got the green light from the government to reopen this week, but only for people who have been vaccinated, which is about half the country at this point. To prove vaccination status, Israel is using an app system called Green Passports. And here to tell us more about it is Joe Fetterman, news director for the Associated Press, who's based in Jerusalem. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on.
Great to have you. Well, with about half the population vaccinated, what does it feel like in Jerusalem?
It is starting to feel normal. You can taste normalcy. I wouldn't call it normal yet, but things are slowly coming alive. You talked about half the population being vaccinated, but in some ways it's actually more than that because children cannot be vaccinated. So it's really about three quarters, almost 80% of the adult population has been vaccinated at this point. And that has given the government some confidence, feeling that it's safe enough to start opening things. So just in the past couple of weeks, we see stores opening, we see restaurants reopening, some concerts, sporting events, like you mentioned. But like you said, most of these things are just for people who can prove that they've been vaccinated.
And anyone who wants to get a vaccine can get one? Anyone?
Anyone. It's when I hear stories from people in other countries, when I speak to my mother back in the U.S., I hear how difficult and the long waits and the uncertainty. Here, it's almost at the point where you can just walk in off the street and get vaccinated at will. They've offered little incentives. If you go, certain HMOs will give you a free cappuccino. One place opened a vaccination center at a bar so you could get a shot with your shot, a shot of whiskey with your shot. So they have all sorts of incentives, and they're really pushing hard to make sure that everybody gets on board.
Well, one group in Israel has been very reluctant, and that's the ultra-Orthodox. What are their objections to getting vaccinated?
Yeah, that's a complicated one. I think part of it is faith, belief in God, and, you know, whatever happens, happens. Part of it has to do with a historically distrustful relationship, I think, with the government. But that said, even the ultra-Orthodox have been getting on board, maybe not as at high a rate as the rest of the population, maybe a little bit behind everyone else, but even the ultra-Orthodox are getting vaccinated.
And they are, what, about 12% of the population there?
Yes, roughly.
One sore point, Israel has received a lot of criticism for this, is that they have not vaccinated the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip or the West Bank. And why haven't they done that?
Yeah, this is a big issue of debate here because, you know, like we said, Israel's done a very good job vaccinating its own people. And you have to, that includes Israel's own Arab minority. About 20% of Israel's population are Arabs. And they also include Palestinian residents of East Jerusalem, which Israel considers East Jerusalem, you know, part of its capital. So Palestinians who live in East Jerusalem were also eligible to be vaccinated. So we're talking about the West Bank and Gaza Strip. The human rights community, UN officials and so forth say Israel has an obligation as an occupying power to take care of the well-being of the 5 million or so people who live in those two territories. Israel says, look, we signed interim peace accords in the 1990s. These accords say the Palestinians are responsible for their own health care. So Israel says it doesn't have that obligation. Now, you know, there's another aspect to this debate. The medical community in Israel overwhelmingly says Israel should vaccinate the Palestinians. Forget about the politics. It just makes sense health-wise because these two populations come into so much contact with one another. It's just the smart thing to do, and some say it's the moral thing to do. And this week, we had an interesting development just a couple of days ago where Israel has begun to vaccinate some of the Palestinian population. They've decided 100,000 Palestinian laborers who enter Israel to work each day, they're eligible to be vaccinated. So that's a step in that direction, but it still leaves, you're talking about a population of over roughly 5 million people. So the vast majority of Palestinians are not vaccinated.
Are they looking to get vaccines elsewhere from Russia or China?
Yeah, so the Palestinians, first of all, publicly, they haven't even asked Israel for help. I can only imagine what's going on behind the scenes. I'm sure that there are some discussions, but the Palestinians are trying on their own. You know, they have their own deals with Russia, and I think it's AstraZeneca. I can't remember which vaccine producer, but they are also part of this WHO, World Health Organization program called COVAX, which is a program to help poorer developing countries around the world. The problem is, even with all of these plans, everything is behind schedule. That COVAX problem, not only with the Palestinians, but worldwide, appears to be suffering from a lack of funding. Things are behind schedule. The bottom line is, despite all of their hopes and all of their plans, the Palestinians have only managed to bring in about 10,000 doses of Russian vaccine so far, which is a drop in the bucket.
Yeah. And meanwhile, what is the COVID situation in the territories?
Yes, it's actually pretty stark when you look at it, because, you know, the science has shown the vaccine does work. So you see all of the key indicators in Israel dropping almost on a daily basis. The number of people who are hospitalized, the number of deaths, the rate of positive tests, all of those indicators that you would normally look at are all moving in the right direction for the Israelis. And in the Palestinian territories, especially the West Bank, it's all going in the wrong direction. They have had to reinstate lockdown measures. Their hospitals are beyond capacity at this point. So things are looking pretty bad right now in the Palestinian areas.
Mm. Back in Israel, though, they have this green passport situation that I talked about. Can you elaborate on that? What does that mean?
Yeah, it was a surprisingly simple process. You go, you get vaccinated. By the time you walk out of the building, you receive a text message telling you to come back for your second dose 3 weeks later. 1 week after that second dose, you're eligible for that green passport. You log on either to your HMO or to the nation's health ministry. You plop in your ID number and you download your green passport. It's a barcode that can either go on your phone or you can print out a hard copy. And once you have that, you can use it to gain admission to all sorts of fun things that we all miss doing.
Hmm. Wow, that seems so efficient.
Yes.
So meanwhile, this is all against the backdrop of yet another election for Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. He's up again for re-election this month. Seems like there always seems to be an election happening in Israel. But anyway, so I guess this is what he's running on, that he was able to lead the world, really, in getting his population vaccinated?
This is the cornerstone of his re-election campaign. Like you said, it feels like we have elections way too often. This is our fourth election in 2 years. Every day, every campaign event, he talks about the vaccination campaign. And he talks about what he's doing, almost like he single-handedly is rescuing the country from the coronavirus. And the challenge for him is that he has been very successful in the vaccination campaign, but there have been a lot of missteps over the past year. The handling of the lockdowns has not always been consistent. It's not always been clear what the rules were. A lot of people are still out of work. Unemployment is still in double digits at this point. And then on top of that, Netanyahu is facing trial on corruption charges. The trial's set to resume in a couple of weeks, just after Election Day. So there are a lot of things going on, and he's trying to keep people's focus on the vaccination campaign because that's one accomplishment that really resonates with the public.
Mm. Right. So that election is March 23rd, so it's coming up. And any prediction as to whether or not he'll actually win re-election?
Despite all of these efforts, despite the campaigning, it's very difficult to say which way it's going to go at this point.
All right. Well, thank you. Thanks for the update on what's happening in Israel.
Thank you for having me on.
Joe Fetterman, news director for Israel and the Palestinian territories for the Associated Press. He's based in Jerusalem. It's a different story in Italy, where less than 5% of the population has been fully vaccinated and cases there are increasing. Italy was the first Western country to be hit hard by the virus last year. Hundreds of people a day died. The streets were empty as the country locked down. 1 year later, Italy has hit a grim milestone. More than 100,000 people have died, Only a few other countries have more than 100,000 people dead, and most of them are a lot bigger. Many of the people who died in Italy were older, but Italy was uniquely devastated because it has the second oldest population in the world. Only Japan has an older population, but it had nowhere near the amount of deaths as Italy. Here to talk about how COVID devastated an entire generation of older Italians is Chico Harlan, Rome bureau chief for The Washington Post. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, let's first talk about the vaccine rollout, because we were just talking about that regarding Israel, where it seems to be going very quickly. Anyone who wants a vaccine in Israel can get one. Why is it going so slowly in Italy?
I mean, it's a combination of factors, but Italy, like all European countries, left its vaccine procurement up to the EU. The EU tried to bet on a bunch of different vaccines. It bet heavily on some of the wrong ones and was banking that it would be able to vaccinate the entire adult population by the end of the summer with a combination of vaccines. There's not many Moderna doses here. And for the ones that are on contract and do seem to work, the deliveries have been slow. They've been behind schedule. So the EU, though on paper it has enough doses to vaccinate the entire population many times over, doesn't actually have enough doses. So people are in some state of a mix between depression and I guess panic or desperation, because they do see other countries moving ahead, Israel obviously being the most prominent example.
And also Italy, as I mentioned, was uniquely devastated because of its older population. And you did a story recently where you traveled to a small city, a population of 72,000, Cremona, near Milan. Can you describe what it looked like there a year after this pandemic began?
Yeah. I mean, very few people are out and about still. The population is on the older side there. I think about 23% are 65 and older. You don't see many people out. And when you show up at the hospital, that's when you see the real activity, because that's now where they're doing these vaccines. So we were there for a couple days when people 80 and older, that's the age that's now eligible in Italy, when people 80 and older were showing up. That's where we did a lot of our interviews. You know, it's not easy to talk to people safely who are in that age bracket. That's why I think, even though we all know that old people are most at risk, I think it still is a little bit underplayed in the media. And we wanted to make sure that we could talk to a large number of people and do it safely. So we were able to do it over the course of 3 days there, talking to dozens of people who were coming in for their vaccine shots.
And when you talk to these older people, 80 plus, what stories did they tell you?
They've been remarkably lonely. You know, I think we're all aware of the common situation where grandparents don't see their kids, don't see their grandkids. But I don't think I had fully appreciated just how comprehensive that stoppage was. A lot of the people we met with didn't make any exceptions on that during the course of the year. They didn't stop for birthdays or for holidays seeing loved ones. They didn't come close to anybody. They stopped seeing their own friends. If they were lucky and had a spouse, that kind of helped them get through. And if they were less lucky and already lived alone, the loneliness was total. And these were the survivors. This was a survival skill, and it worked, because in this particular place, after March of last year, which was horrifying, they didn't really have such a huge second wave. And a lot of the people we talked to my surprise, hadn't lost a lot of friends. They had bunkered down, but the bunkering down came with its own enormous cost.
I guess, what does that loneliness now look like now that they can go out and get a vaccine and maybe open up a little bit? What are the lingering effects?
I mean, a lot of antidepressants and a lot of lost friendships. You know, if you think about someone who's in their 80s, we were oftentimes getting excited about, oh, let's interview this person. And then it was hard to hear. It was hard to talk unless you were really shouting or they could see your mouth moving without the mask. Phone calls are hard for a lot of these people. They depended on seeing people in person, on getting together at coffee shops or at the senior center would shut down. And so people's worlds got smaller. The vaccine represents a hope for sure, because certain things will restart and restart safely, like seeing family. So that's a huge a huge aspect of just love and family camaraderie that people should be able to get back. But there were other parts of their lives, the ones that revolved more around socializing and friends, that don't seem like they're going to come back as quickly, if at all.
Right, because a lot of their friends died.
And that too.
You report on one nursing home of 400 where 100 people died just in this one nursing home, 25%.
Yeah, 100 people in a month. The director pointed to one wing and he was basically like 50% of the people here just got wiped out almost immediately. It was the Alzheimer's area where they couldn't remember to wear masks. But that's an extraordinary proportion of people in a place that was normally having 5 or 6 deaths a month to have 100 all of a sudden. So that's the way this thing arrived in town, just, you know, with a complete explosion.
Oh, that is so sad. And, you know, against the backdrop of Italy, a lot of these towns, the young people have left, right, because they can't find work. So the majority of the population is older. So I guess it feels even more devastating, like a neutron bomb went off or something.
Well, you know, the hardest hit area, Lombardy region, is actually one of the wealthiest. It's one of the few that retains young people. Really, the biggest factor was just that there is such an elderly population. There are so many people older than 80 in Italy. And those are the people that die from this disproportionately. So Italy was left vulnerable.
And it seems like it's still vulnerable because of the low vaccination rate.
Well, it's still vulnerable, but among those who are getting vaccinated, it's the elderly. They're working through that group. And soon enough, you'll have a large proportion of the 80 plus protected. Already, it's about a quarter of the people 80 and older who have gotten at least one shot. So it's not good. It's not full protection, but they're getting there. Give it another month or two, and I think it'll be well farther along. So by then, the death toll should go down substantially just based on that. And then you enter a point where the virus is still spreading among a huge number of people in the population, but you're not seeing those death tolls that are like 800 people a day, 1,000 people a day. I think that part of the horror story is over.
Well, I guess one bit of good news there. Thank you so much.
Thank you for being interested and for having me on.
My pleasure. Chico Harlan, Rome Bureau Chief for The Washington Post. Coming up, why older Italian men are roaming the countryside in search of truffles.
It's something that science hasn't cracked the code on. A white truffle can't be cultivated. It's something that exists beyond the boundaries of human knowledge.
Truffle hunters and their dogs. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Nestled in the picturesque hillsides of Piedmont in northern Italy and buried beneath the soil under an auburn canopy of trees lies white gold, or more specifically, the white truffle. It's a coveted delicacy in fine cuisine, fetching hundreds of dollars for just a few ounces. The biggest ones have sold for tens, even hundreds of thousands of dollars. Here's how James Beard Award-winning critic and restaurateur Patrick Kew described it a few years ago on KCRW's Good Food.
The white truffle shaved table side is one of the great moments. Incredibly perfumed, very aromatic, eaten raw over, just makes anything better. Usually something very modest. I mean, this is the beauty of truffles. When you pair them with modest things, a polenta, a pasta, that's the beauty of truffles.
The beauty of truffles is also in how you find them. A new documentary takes us to a world of elderly Italian men and their trusty dogs combing the countryside for white truffles. The movie is called The Truffle Hunters. It premiered last year at Sundance, and it's currently running at just one theater here for the moment, the Vineland Drive-In in the City of Industry. The directors, Michael Dweck and Gregory Kershaw, join me now. Welcome.
Hey, Madeline. It's awesome to be here with you.
Well, it's great to have you. So it's all old Italian men doing this, which is interesting because it's such a physically tasking job. Just describe what it's like to be a truffle hunter. What do they do?
Well, we found out it's a secret. You know, everything in that world is a secret, where they find the truffles, who's hunting for the truffles. And everybody we found out in these villages are protecting these truffle hunters. You know, it took us a while. It took us 3 years to make this film. And maybe the first 3 or 4 months that we were there, we didn't film a thing. All we did was just try to immerse ourselves in this community. And what we found out, there were these small group of men between 80 and 90 years old, you know, for generations, they've learned this wisdom of how to find this truffle. And a truffle cannot be cultivated. And everybody has a different theory of how it blooms. Some think it has to do with when lightning strikes. Some people think it's the phase of the moon. Others rely on water diviners to tell them of electric magnetic currents under the soil. But there's just a small handful of people that really know how to find this thing.
Let me play a clip from your movie. It's in Italian, so I'll try to paraphrase. And this is Aurelio Conterno talking about, well, truffle hunting.
Perché poi la cosa bella, ricordati bene.
Okay, so he says you have to find a place, the best place, a place you couldn't even imagine. You have to go with a dog, a good dog or a bad dog, better with a good dog. And if you don't trust your dog, you shouldn't go truffle hunting. So you have to have a dog, right? It used to be pigs, I guess, but would the pigs eat the truffles and that's why they went with dogs?
Well, the pigs will eat the truffles. They may actually even bite your finger off if your finger gets in the way of them eating the truffles. So the dogs are, they have incredibly sensitive noses, but they also have a tremendous amount of energy because they're out in the woods truffle hunting, sometimes 12 hours a night. And when making the film, we knew that the dogs were incredibly important to telling the story, that as characters, they were just as important as their human counterparts. And we wanted to bring the audience into the perspective of the dog. So we created, actually with an Italian shoe cobbler, we created a rig that we call the doggy cam, but it's a little harness that goes around the dog's head. And it allowed us to put a GoPro camera and mount it right on their head. And so you see the dog's perspective in the world and you go on the thrill of the hunt with them and you see the excitement, the ecstatic joy of these dogs digging up a truffle and interacting with their truffle hunting companions.
The truffle hunting companions, AKA the men in your movie, are singularly, shall I say, eccentric. They're an odd group. How would you describe them?
Well, the first thing that comes to mind is passionate. The 3.5 months of truffle season from September to January, they're out walking at night because they don't want people to know where they go, 15 to 20 miles a night, 80 to 90-year-old men with their dogs looking for truffles. And, you know, what Greg was saying about their relationship that they have with dogs is quite unique. I mean, what we learned from our footage from the dog's point of view is that the characters have what seems to be conversations with their dogs. In Aurelio's case, he was talking to Berba about, well, what happens if I take a long trip? What if I don't come back? Who's going to take care of you, Charlie and Biscotto, the other two dogs? And then he started to speak about Christmas. He said, I'm going to prepare a lunch for you for Christmas. And I've gone to the neighboring village and I've got you celery and carrots and chicken. I'm going to prepare you a very special meal. And that came as a surprise. We only saw that when we looked at the doggy cam footage for the first time. And we learned that, yeah, they have a love of the dogs. A lot of times they treat them as children because a lot of the children have gone and a lot of the men they're single at this point. And this is their companion. But every character in the film is quite different. Angelo, who we see typing at the typewriter, and he refuses to truffle hunt anymore because he thinks that it's been commercialized and has no interest in it. He's, you know, fairly eccentric. He lives in this beautiful, dilapidated Italian villa with his 7 dogs. And he just types letters on his old Olivetti typewriter just to the local government and talks about how he wants truffle hunting to change and to be the way it was before. And these people have no technology. They don't have computers or cell phones, which is really, for us, refreshing. They live in a pre-digital world. And of course, there's some beautiful things about living in that world.
Yeah. When we first heard about this world of truffle hunters and we heard these rumors of these older men that went out into the woods and we were told they were often in their 70s, 80s, we thought that, you know, this might be a film about aging. But when we started spending time with these truffle hunters, we realized it was quite the opposite. It almost felt like we were in Italy in the 1960s. And these very old men, they were so filled with life, and it felt like we were around young men. They were just bursting with joy. They were bubbling over with mirth. And that spirit, the spirit that they carry with them, that's really what we tried to capture in the film. And that was the starting place, is trying to transmit this feeling that we felt around them, this life lived to its fullest potential.
Well, what is it that makes them bubble over with mirth? Why are they so full of life? Is it the hunt for the truffle? Is it the fact that they have this relationship with their dogs and with nature? Is it that and all that and more? What is it?
Well, I think the lives that they live, most of them are farmers, and they've lived what they consider to be very simple lives. But when we were with them, that we realized that they hold tremendous wisdom. And it's not just the wisdom that allows them to pull these truffles out of the ground, which is this nearly magical feat, but it's what you just mentioned. It's this connection to nature, this connection to community, this connection to the local history, all those very simple things that they've been able to hold on to, and that in so many ways have been stripped from the modern world.
Mm. And it is all men, right? No women are doing this?
We didn't come across any women. That it seemed that women in this community have a passion unto their own, which is hunting for Puccini mushrooms, and the men are out there looking for truffles.
And it's the truffles that are worth so much money. And so that has introduced a shady element to this whole endeavor. They talk about ruthless people trying to poison their dogs so that the dogs can't find the truffles.
Yeah, it's horrific that somebody would think of doing that to a dog, especially knowing how close the truffle hunters are to their dogs. But that, you know, that's an end result of many things. You know, the truffles now, you know, they're in short supply and shorter every year because of climate change. There's less and less places that you can find truffles. And there's a demand. The demand is now coming from Asia. It's coming from South America. It's coming from the U.S. And it's coming from Europe. And there's just a small handful of people that know how to find this piece of gold.
Well, let's talk about the market for truffles. And I just want to play a clip of tape of one of the truffle hunters, Egidio Gagliardi. And he is talking with a truffle merchant, a younger man named Gianfranco Curti. And they're talking on a darkened street. So it seems almost like they're doing a drug deal. So they're talking about how much it weighs and the perfume, the aroma of the truffles. And says a truffle without aroma would be worth nothing. It's the scent that matters. And this is just one of several scenes that you record of a transaction, but they all seem to be done quite furtively. Why? Why are they done in the dark of night?
I mean, everything about this world is a secret. And so the truffle hunters, they're out in the woods all night looking for truffles. And the reason is because they don't want anybody to know where they're finding the truffles. They don't want people to know where they go truffle hunting. But the same thing when they're selling the truffles. I mean, the world of truffles is a lot like, I mean, you described it as maybe like a drug deal. And that's how it's been described to us. And it happens under the cover of darkness. We heard rumors when we first started filming. We heard rumors for months about this black market that occurred on this one street in this particular town twice a week in the middle of the night. And so we went to check it out, but we actually went in the day. And we talked to all the different shopkeepers on the street, and it's an Italian town. So these shops had been there for generations, and none of them told us that they had ever heard of this market. So we went back to the truffle hunters who told us about it, and we said, there's clearly no market here. Maybe we have the wrong street. And they said, no, just go back in the middle of the night. And we did. And we went back at 4 o'clock in the morning. And it was actually the first year that we were filming. And there was a drought that year. There were very few truffles. And all the truffle dealers were desperate to find truffles because they have clients all around the world. And there was a line of these truffle dealers, some of whom we knew, and they were just standing there in a line. And they kind of almost looked like drug addicts waiting for their next fix because they were so desperate at that time. And out of nowhere, there was a little, in the region, they drive these little SUVs called pandas, and a little panda pulled up. And the driver got out and he opened up the back of the trunk and the street just filled with the aroma of truffles. And all the truffle dealers scurried over to him and they pulled out their cash and they started trying to make deals. But I think part of that mystery of how a truffle is found, how a truffle is sold, that's what drew us into this story. And I think it's just, that's the beautiful thing about a truffle. It's something that kind of exists outside the laws of human beings. And it's something that science hasn't cracked the code on. A white truffle can't be cultivated. It's something that really exists beyond the boundaries of human knowledge.
And why aren't there younger truffle hunters doing this? Why is it just these old guys?
Well, a couple of reasons. First, the young people have left and gone to look for work outside the country. And second, we found that this passion, it's work. You know, truffle hunting is a lot of work. You have to be willing to dig in the mud in the freezing cold. It's typically 20 degrees or 25 degrees out. It's a lot of snow. And you're out there for, you know, 8 to 10 hours a night. And the chance of finding a truffle in a night is almost zero. Maybe it takes 2 or 3 weeks. Maybe you find like a little nugget, but they don't do it for the money. Of course, they do it for the passion. It's just like they're all like young men. They don't seem like they're in their 80s.
But they're not going to live forever, these men. As you say, they're in their 80s and 90s. Does this die out with them?
I think that's part of the reason why we made this film. When we started encountering the truffle hunters, we realized how fragile this tradition was. And it does seem like people will continue truffle hunting. I mean, they're just worth so much money. But it's hard to imagine they're going to continue doing it the way that the people we filmed with do it. And the most basic level change is that the people that we filmed with, they don't have a smartphone in their pocket. And just that alone, it transforms the way that you interact with nature. It transforms the way you interact with other people. And these beautiful pre-digital lives that the people we filmed with have, it doesn't feel like it will be carried on in the same way with future generations.
Well, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Yeah, thank you, Madeline.
Thanks, Madeline. Thanks, Madeline.
That's Michael Dweck and Gregory Kershaw. Their new documentary is called The Truffle Hunters. It's showing now at the Vineland Drive-In in the City of Industry. And there will be a wider release in Southern California next month. Coming up, you've heard of Bitcoin. Well, now there's digital art that's sold via blockchain. It's called NFTs, or non-fungible tokens. If you have absolutely no idea what those words I just said mean, well, stay tuned. All will be explained next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Rock band Kings of Leon made more than $2 million this month after they released their new album as something called an NFT. That stands for non-fungible token. And that's basically digital memorabilia sold online using cryptocurrency. And if your eyes are pretty much starting to glaze over hearing that word, cryptocurrency, just hang on. Stay with us for a second because, well, this is interesting. You can make a lot of money in NFTs. A video of NBA star LeBron James dunking a basketball recently sold for $200,000 as an NFT. A GIF of a pixelated cat with a Pop-Tart body sold for more than $600,000. And Twitter CEO Jack Dorsey is now selling his very first tweet. It's from 2006, and it reads, "Just setting up my Twitter," that as an NFT. Bids for that tweet are currently around $2.5 million. Here to explain more about this wild world of non-fungible tokens is Kate Nibb, senior writer for Wired. Hi.
Hi, thanks for having me.
All right. What is the most understandable definition of an NFT you can give me?
Okay. Well, it stands for non-fungible token. Non-fungible is just a fancy way of saying unique or rare. It's something original. And token, it just means it's basically a little digital item. Using a metaphor to like memorabilia, like baseball cards or even, you know, when Beanie Babies were super popular and everyone was convinced they'd be worth millions, it's sort of like digital Beanie Babies.
Digital Beanie Babies. I like that as a definition, which also raises the specter of a fad that will burn out. Is this just a fad?
I think it's too soon to tell, to be honest. I think it definitely seems like it's a bubble. a lot of the valuations for these digital items is frankly hard to process. In addition to the LeBron James clip that sold for $200,000and Jack's tweet, there is a digital artist named Beeple, and he sold a digital painting of a Donald Trump nude and covered in graffiti. Apparently, it's a comment on the 2020 election for $6.6 million. So, you know, I think that these valuations are hard to square as something that could be sustainable, but I also am not really sure it's just a flash in the pan. There's a lot of exciting stuff going on here, too.
Well, explain exactly how the money part of it works, because if you're creating something that's digital, it can be repeated, right? I mean, it can be sold over and over again. I mean, for example, that tweet that Jack Dorsey is selling, that still exists on Twitter. So how is it worth potentially millions of dollars?
Someone decided that a signed certificate of the tweet was worth $2.5 million. I don't know why they decided that, but that is what they're willing to pay. It's important to note that the tweet itself is not for sale. The tweet, you know, Jack could delete that tweet if he wanted to. It's just the NFT of the tweet that is for sale. And so it could actually, you know, if there was another platform that came around and was offering the same exact tweet for sale, there could potentially be two copies of it. Like, this is why it gets so confusing and why it is such a wild world. It's not well regulated. And, you know, I think that there's probably a lot of opportunities for people to get ripped off in various ways if they don't understand that all they're really buying is the equivalent of an autographed copy of something, not the thing itself.
I see. You had an experience yourself with this. You tweeted something and someone out of the blue offered you money for it?
Yes. And I want to be clear, it wasn't that good of a tweet. I truly don't know why they paid money for it. I actually asked them and they just didn't respond. But yeah, so I was researching this story and I started playing around with this service called Valuables by Cent. It's this platform for trading tweets as NFTs. It's the one that Jack Dorsey is using. And I tweeted that I was playing around with it, and I tweeted that one of my tweets was for sale. No one bought it. But then a few days later, someone did offer me $500 for a tweet, and I accepted it. I didn't actually get $500. I got 0.3 Ether, which is what they call the Ethereum cryptocurrency. And yeah, I really don't know why they did that. I don't think anything that I tweet is really worth any money, but I just thought I might as well take it as a sort of reporting experiment.
So what do you do with 0.3 Ether? Like, how do you buy anything with that?
So I would probably transfer it from the cryptocurrency wallet that it was deposited in to a market like Coinbase, and then I could sell it for U.S. dollars if I wanted to sell it. I'm not a cryptocurrency expert either, but you basically just have to sell it, and if someone wants to buy it, they'll pay you real American dollars for it.
So it looks like a lot of people are looking into getting into this or have gotten into this. How big can this get?
I mean, basically anything on the internet can be an NFT. So there are almost infinite possibilities. There are a lot of artists doing some really cool work in this space, you know, using algorithms to generate all sorts of interesting abstract digital images. And I think in the art world, it has a lot of potential. It already has proven itself to be quite popular in the sports world with those NBA clips. I think it really depends on how much of this is just speculation that will burn out and how much of this is driven by authentic interest in these digital items. And honestly, I don't know what is more likely.
It sounds like nobody really knows, but it's exciting and interesting anyway. Thank you for coming on the show today and explaining it.
Thanks for having me.
Kate Nibbs, senior writer at Wired, covering culture, and you can read her story on NFTs at wired.com. And that'll do it for us today here on Press Play. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.